may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. And may it please the Court, my name is Mike Melkerson. I represent the appellant, Property Damage Specialists, Inc., in this case. This case is a case concerning a lawsuit for retaliatory discharge for an employee that was fired after filing a health and safety complaint with the Virginia arm of OSHA. The question today is whether the statute at issue, which is Virginia Code 40.1-51.1:2, which I'll refer to during these proceedings as Section 2:2, whether that statute permits an employee to recover as one element of his damages, punitive damages. The statute begins using some language that I believe is indicative of the legislature's intent, which is ultimately the question for the Court to decide is what that intention is, as expressed by the plain language and meaning of the statute. Specifically, in subsection A of that statute, it empowers the commissioner to attempt to have the violation, that is, the retaliation, abated, and the statute uses this language, without economic loss to the employee. So the entire statute is focused in on that issue, is whether and to what extent a remedy needs to be fashioned to avoid economic loss to the employee. Punitive damages, by contrast, are related to punishment, obviously. And the specific language in subsection A of the statute, where it refers to the court having jurisdiction for cause shown to order appropriate relief, it then gives a series of examples of what type of relief is appropriate, all of which are compensatory in nature, which is, of course, is consistent with the purpose of the statute, which is to abate the violation without economic loss to the employee. That same identical language is then used in subsection B of the statute, which indicates that to the extent the commissioner does not bring an action on behalf of the employee, which the statute indicates that he should do to the extent that he finds a violation, in this case the commissioner did not do that, that the employee then would have the right to bring that action. The appellee argues that somehow the language in subsection A is different and should be interpreted in a different light than in subsection B. But if you think about it, that doesn't really make much sense. Because if that were true, then what it would mean is that in cases where the commissioner would find that there is a meritorious case and the case should proceed on behalf of the employee, the Department of Labor then brings that case. Under the appellee's interpretation of the statute, the commissioner would be more limited in the damages that he could assert on behalf of the employee, he or she, than the employee could assert himself to the extent that the commissioner doesn't bring an action after the commissioner finds the case is not meritorious. And that simply doesn't make any sense. And so that's the reason why, based on the statutory interpretation principle of the consistent usage rule, we think that the appropriate relief language, as used in subsection B of section 2:2, should be interpreted in the same fashion and with the same limitations as it is in subsection A. And because all of the modifying terms in subsection A relate to damages that are compensatory in nature, under the principle, as I cited in our brief, of adjudicatus generis, that under that principle that the limiting language that follows the general language should inform this court's interpretation of that language. And of course, a similar principle, nascitur associus, says that when the meaning of the surrounding words are again limiting in nature, that has to inform the court's interpretation of the more general words. And that's what we have here. At the heart of the issue today is whether this court should employ a liberal construction in the interpretation of the statute to the extent the court finds it to be ambiguous, which I would suggest that under the plain meaning of the statute that it is not, even if the court were to apply a liberal interpretation. But the appropriate interpretation is in part what is at the heart of the dispute between the parties. My client's position is that an appropriate interpretation is that this should be strictly construed because it's in derogation of the common law, whereas the appellee claims that it should be liberally construed because the statute is remedial in nature. I've cited in our brief the Crone versus Richmond newspapers case where this court long ago indicated that the normal rule of liberal construction of remedial statutes has to give in to the rule of strict construction when the statute at issue is in derogation of the common law. More recently, this court itself, in the case of Das v. Jamco in 1997, this court was looking at a provision of the Virginia Human Rights Act. As this court may recall, in 1994, in the case of Lockhart v. Commonwealth, this court interpreted that Virginia Human Rights Act statute as establishing a public policy, and then under Bowman, allowing a private cause of action, even though the statute didn't specifically allow it. And that, because that recognized cause of action was in the nature of a tort, punitive damages were potentially available. In 1995, the General Assembly amended the Virginia Human Rights Act and provided a specific cause of action therein. Then in 1997, this court, in the case of Das v. Jamco, was called upon to decide whether a person that was claiming pregnancy discrimination under the statute, where her claims didn't necessarily fit under the express terms of the statute, whether or not she could necessarily proceed under the common law theory that this court acknowledged in Bowman for violating the public policy of the common law for retaliatory discharge. And this court said no. And in doing so, this court interpreted the 1995 amendments to the Virginia Human Rights Act strictly. Why? Because they're in derogation of the common law. And that interpretation that was adopted by this court was done despite the fact that it's in the context of a statute that has a remedial purpose. Certainly, I don't think anybody would suggest that to protect injured workers is any less or more important than protecting the rights of pregnant women in the workplace. But notwithstanding that fact, that's the interpretation this court adopted, because that has been the longstanding rule of this Commonwealth.
So your point is there is no common law claim even being alleged here, and if there were one, it would be displaced by the statute anyway.
That is correct, Your Honor. In fact, at the time this statute was enacted in 1979, Virginia had not yet recognized any type of claim for retaliatory discharge. That only came with Bowman, which was decided in 1985. So, and for a similar reason, if you compare, you know, the appellee says, well, you know, the federal courts interpret this statute on the federal side, which concerns similar language, not identical language, but similar, uses the phrase all appropriate relief as opposed to appropriate relief. And there have been only two federal reported decisions that have interpreted the statute to allow punitive damages on the federal side. The problem with that is, you know, as I pointed out in my brief, is that in federal court, they use a different presumption and a different statutory interpretation mechanism than we use in Virginia. In federal court, they use what they call the Franklin presumption. And what that presumption states is that to the extent that Congress has not specifically limited the federal court's power, it is assumed, presumed, that the federal court has all available power to award any remedy. That certainly is not the rule in Virginia. But despite the fact that has been the presumption that's applied in federal cases, there have only been two that have interpreted the federal counterpart to the Virginia statute in this manner. Those two cases, the very first case that interpreted that way, was not decided until 1994. And so at the time the Virginia statute was enacted in 1979, there was no authority, federal or state, that would give any indication to the General Assembly that punitive damages would be available if they didn't specifically exclude them. And on that note, the appellee brings up the issue of, well, you know, in certain other statutes, the General Assembly has specifically excluded punitive damages. So the argument goes is that to the extent that they didn't exclude it here, perhaps it should just be assumed that it's allowed. Well, the difference is that in the statutes where the General Assembly has excluded punitive damages specifically, those statutes have typically come in connection with rights that would otherwise be protected by the Virginia Constitution. For example, with the Virginia Human Rights Act, that was amended in 1995 to specifically forbid punitive damages. For example, the Handicap Act that protects access to handicapped persons in Virginia, both of those acts specifically exclude punitive damages. And the reason is because the Virginia statute, Virginia Code 1-10, that specifically states that the common law shall remain in full force and effect here in Virginia unless clearly abrogated by the General Assembly, that there is an exception to that. And that is to the extent that the Constitution of the state of Virginia would otherwise require a different result. And so when you have certain protected classes, like the handicapped, or you know, classes that are protected because of gender, or race, or pregnancy, or things of this nature, punitive damages in those cases, even though not recognized at common law, potentially could be enacted, or potentially could be recognized by the court, absent an express policy expressed by the General Assembly that they're not allowed. So that's why you see in some of the statutes that express policy of no punitive damages, while others, like in the statute at issue here, that doesn't concern a protected class, it's not necessary for the General Assembly to express that, because the rule in 1979 when this statute was enacted was specifically that unless you expressly provide for punitive damages, they don't exist. And that's what this the appellee is attempting to have the court do, and is what the trial court did, was to allow punitive damages in derogation of the common law, despite the fact that the statute doesn't allow it, and despite the fact that the statutory language, even if liberally interpreted, would dictate that punitive damages are not allowed, because it's not the type of remedy that is listed in the statute that is similar to the ultimate to the other remedies that are listed and necessary to abate the economic loss to the employee. I may reserve the remainder of my time unless the court has questions for rebuttal.
You have 3 minutes and 43 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Simpson. I represent Aaron Rechichar. This is a case involving human health and safety, particularly workplace safety. In the property damages opening brief, in their conclusion, they indicate that the question posed by this case is whether it was wise to permit juries to award punitive damages in cases where employees have been terminated because they have reported health or safety concerns. And I think that we disagree about a lot in this case in our briefs, that's obvious, but we would agree with the appellant that that is a key and fundamental issue in this case. And I'd like to address
whether it is wise.
Yes, whether it's wise.
Why don't we just ask ourselves what the General Assembly intended? Why don't we just ask ourselves what the General Assembly intended?
Right, and I think in the context of evaluating the particular language at issue in this case, appropriate relief in the context of workplace safety, I think it is helpful to approach it from the standpoint of what is the wisdom here. I think that can be discerned from the language utilized, chosen by the General Assembly.
In my personal experience, reasonable people can disagree as to what's wise and unwise.
That's right. But I'd like to at least try to approach the issues of the case from that question. It was posed by property damage specialists, and I think it is helpful to try, at least. So starting from the proposition of what is wise and what is wisdom, I think we can agree that it's doing what's morally right at a minimum. There are going to be a lot of decisions that we're called upon in life to make that emotions don't really tell us what the right decision is, but the wrong decision can be devastating. So it's at least doing what's morally right, but it's more than that. There's a German Old Testament scholar named Gerhard von Rad. He defined wisdom as being having practical knowledge of the way things are, the way things work, and what to do with them, being in touch with reality, the way reality really is. So there's a knowledge component that goes along with making wise decisions. And in the area of workplace safety, our knowledge is informed to some extent by our experiences. My experiences of workplace safety as a lawyer, like how I appreciate it, is going to be informed by sitting in an office as a white-collar person. My client, as a blue-collar employee, his knowledge of workplace danger and safety is very different than mine. And for those who occupy positions where they're involved in heavy equipment, harsh chemicals, their knowledge component is very different than mine or other white-collar persons. So when we have a jury, as we had in this case, composed of a cross-section, folks who may have white-collar jobs, who may have blue-collar jobs, who may know people, have friends or family, who work in jobs that expose them to dangers that are different than those that we experience in the workplace, we have a collective wisdom, and that was exercised in this case. The jury exercises collective wisdom and determined that it was appropriate to award punitive damages in this case.
But the question is whether punitive damages are allowed under the statute.
That's right. And the statute uses the words appropriate relief. And I think we can all agree that appropriate is an intentionally broad term. My first job out of law school, I handled child abuse and neglect cases for the state of Hawaii, and I did hundreds and hundreds of orders, and it's etched in my brain that one of the orders was that the parents shall undergo a psychological evaluation as recommended by the department and participate and attend with such follow-up therapy as deemed appropriate by the department. And I'd have parents' attorneys that would approach me and say, appropriate, that can mean almost anything. And they were right. We insisted on that. And we felt it was wise not to take any tools out of the toolbox when it came to protecting the safety and well-being, particularly of children. And
can
this
I
situation
call your work, attention to the Wilson case? Maybe that's an example of our lack of wisdom, but in Wilson, we're looking at the expression fair and just, also lofty and calling the greater human values to stake type of phrase. And we said, you know what, based upon the common law, there being no recovery to begin with under Lord Campbell's Act, how can we possibly say that this language should not be read more narrowly than we ordinarily would because of that dynamic? That's similar here, is it not?
The difference is, and I tried to address that in the brief, is in the wrongful death context, there are some similarities because there the General Assembly created a private right of action to bring a cause of action, which is, I think, what we're talking about here, the cause of action being wrongful termination. But with respect to what was the issue and how that's distinguishable is that that's an action brought by the survivors for compensation, what they would have received from the decedent. And therefore, it's a very different context than what we have here. We have an ongoing, also, it's clear from the entire, where this particular law sits in the state occupation health and safety section of the code, that there's more involved here than just an individual claimant. And therefore, I think of the purpose of the law, it's made absolutely clear, and the policy of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I'll just read a couple of the sections to illustrate it. Section 4151.1, it shall be the duty of every employer to furnish each of his employees safe employment. In Section 4151.21, no person shall discharge or in any way discriminate against an employee because the employee has filed a safety or health complaint. I think we can all agree that it's wise for employers to provide safe employment. There may be financial reasons why they short-term or try to go expediently and take a shortcut on that, but ultimately, that is a foolish decision because people can get hurt, the business can fail. It's a wise policy of this Commonwealth.
Well, counsel, instead of focusing on the word appropriate and let's focus on the word relief. How is it relief to the employee to give punitive damages to the employer?
I read the words together, and relief is not separate from appropriate. It's appropriate.
Well, I know, but but relief, for example, in Section A, it says including rehiring or reinstatement of the employee to his former position with back pay plus interest.
Right.
Those are all things that the employee gets.
That's right.
And you're saying relief is actually defined as punitive damages against the employer. How is that relief to the employee?
It's relief. It's appropriate relief for the circumstances and the reality of what these cases involve for a number of reasons. Punitive damages is, I think, appropriate, and use the word I keep coming back to, wise in cases, and I don't think there's any disagreement about this, where there has been an intentional, deliberate harm in violation of someone's rights or the laws. And there are three reasons for that. One, to protect the public. Two, to punish the wrongdoer. And three, to set an example for others so they don't do the same thing.
Right. That, I would agree with you that that's the purpose of punitive damages. But again, that's not giving relief to the employee, is it?
It is giving appropriate relief in cases where, in the case where an employee has been discharged or discriminated against. But particularly, let me see if I can unpack it a little bit differently. the actual section of the code that we're involved with gives a private right of action for employees to bring, among other things, a wrongful discharge claim. The law also prohibits employers from discriminating against employees who make workplace or report workplace safety concerns to the extent that they are demoted, that they are given, that their wages are reduced, that they, other workplace actions that may be taken by those employees, are, they're not without a remedy. But in this particular case, the cause of action was wrongful termination, which this court has consistently said appropriate to a wrongful termination includes, appropriate relief includes punitive damages. So the cause of action here was wrongful termination. The right of action given by the General Assembly is the code section that we're dealing with here. And there are other.
Well, that presupposes that the Bowman claim is not displaced by the statutory right of action. I mean, if what your logic, if your logic were right, it wouldn't matter. Any of this debate we're having would be irrelevant because you'd be able to come in and say, look, well, whether the statute allows it or not, I get it under common law, and the statute's just a predicate for my common law action.
Right. The statute is the General Assembly giving a private right of action for this cause of action, just like the wrongful death statute allowed a private right of action for a cause of action that otherwise would not have existed because the death of the, victim, the plaintiff, or whatever, would have extinguished that claim. That's analogous to what we have here, where the General Assembly has said that this statute provides a private right of action to bring a cause of action when the employee has been discriminated against. Here, the discrimination was wrongful termination.
So if the appellant is right and the statute language, the relief language, does not include punitives, are you still arguing, well, I disagree with that, but even so, I have the Bowman line of cases to give me punitives?
The problem that I have with that is I've got a much more simple mind than that, and the laying out this level of complexity for litigants and their attorneys that you probably need to plead the statute where it says that you have the right to bring these actions and then also plead a Bowman claim. I know that when we file cases, we're often concerned about, and when we're defending cases, the same thing, that we don't want to leave out a claim, but ultimately the cases get down to fairly simple issues and facts. I don't see any reason.
Isn't it wise, counsel, to have both a common law and a statutory claim pled if there's any doubt whatsoever?
I guess the problem I have with that, Your Honor, is that I don't think there is any doubt because the statute at issue in this case doesn't displace the common law. The cause of action is the common law wrongful termination cause of action. The statute doesn't say anything about what causes of action. It gives a right of action to bring a cause of action. But you have to have the cause of action. So the idea that when the statute gives you the express right to bring a cause of action, that you have to plead another, I mean, you certainly can. Whether that is helpful, whether that is necessary, those are different questions.
Do I understand you correctly that you're saying that if you specifically plead a statutory cause of action and you never mention, you never give notice to the court that you're going to make a common law argument as well, that you're allowed to do so?
Yeah, I think where we're passing each other on this is when you say a statutory cause of action, I don't believe that the claim that we brought in this case was a statutory cause of action. I believe that the statute gave us the right to bring a cause of action, which was a common law cause of action, wrongful termination.
You've lost me.
Okay.
I'm just not as smart as you.
Just like, maybe I can explain it this way, in the wrongful death statute, it gave a right to bring an action, but the action or actions that it gave the right to bring are common law causes of action. So this statute did not by itself create a cause of action for wrongful termination. That cause of action already existed. The statute merely allowed private citizens to bring those claims under certain circumstances. So I don't know whether we're talking about what sort of distinction we're making here, but in any event, appropriate relief is a broad term. I don't agree with property damage specialist's analysis of subsection A of the code here, where it lists appropriate relief, the general type of relief, and then lists specific examples of that after the general, and the argument that therefore the general is confined to the specifics. That's not the way that rule of construction works in any event. So I guess the overall concern that this case raises is how did two things. First of all, we haven't really talked about the federal OSHA Act requirements and state compliance with those and having standards that are at least as effective as the federal law. But the intentional decision to choose appropriate relief and how both on the federal level, and I think the jury in this case, wisely determined that it was appropriate.
Counsel, how broad is the term appropriate relief? If you had asked for, if you had said, Your Honor, I'd like for the jury to be instructed about attorney's fees. Because I think that it's not appropriate that an injured individual would have to bear his own attorney's fees under a situation such as this. Would that be permitted?
I have a little mea culpa on that, Your Honor. When I started with this case, and then that issue came up on demur, I conceded it. And in the context, actually, of learning the law here and preparing for this appeal,
hypothetically, if you were now to go in front, back in front of Judge
Hopkins, I would do it differently. I would say yes, appropriate relief includes attorney's fees because that's what happens in the federal system.
Okay,
that's the way OSHA interprets this. Same appropriate relief. So yes, and I think I agree with that. And if I could go back and do that over again, I would. And I'd be standing here at the end of this case, depending on how the court was to affirm this, I'd be asking for fees for it. Which brings
what about if you said, Your Honor, I intend to, since I have not prevailed at trial, I intend to file a notice of appeal. And, Your Honor, I'd like to have an order saying that I get my attorney's fees on appeal as well if I prevail. Would that be appropriate? Because, once again, it's not right. It's not for somebody who's been injured to have to pay their own attorney.
I'm not sure I understood what you're
asking. Prospective attorney's fees on appeal if you prevail.
If I had asked for them and received them in the trial court, I think the rules provide for a recovery of them on appeal as well.
What about an action? What about an order from the court saying that somebody who has purposely caused an injury of this nature should take some sort of remedial educational program to ensure that they are sensitive to workplace safety in the future? Would that be appropriate in order to prevent future injuries?
I think you could make that argument. I think the problem with that and whether it would be determined appropriate is that the state VOSH process, you don't have the record in this case, but in terms of what they do, that's part of what they did administratively in this case in terms of educational requirements, changes in the workplace procedures. That's part of that.
But could that be done as a private cause of action filed in the Shenandoah County Circuit Court by a former employee?
I'm not sure whether the employee would have standing to do that, but I haven't thought about that. That wasn't an issue in this case because the state...
If standing were not argued, were set aside, would that be appropriate relief under the statute? I'm just trying to determine how wide that term can become.
I think how wide it becomes is going to be limited to who the plaintiff is, because under that subsection, it's an individual employee bringing the claim, and therefore I think there's got to be some limits to that. I don't think you can go into going back to the workplace where the employee is not working there, has no interest there, and the appropriate relief can involve matters that don't at all relate to the employee.
The punitive damages don't relate to the employee. Punitive damages are intended to as a sanction and to ensure that that conduct doesn't occur again in the future. It's beyond what compensates the employee. It's essentially almost a windfall to the employee.
That's right.
It's trying to prevent bad conduct in the future. And if you say to someone, well, you are going to have to go do remedial courses in workplace safety, it has the same policy benefit that punitive damages have. So therefore, would it be appropriate?
My problem with that is that's engrafting a whole new public policy relief or remedy that is not part of our jurisprudence. For punitive damages, it is, and you're right, that that is in some ways a windfall for the plaintiff, but that's the sound policy and wisdom of that jurisprudence, is that that punishes the wrongdoer, it protects the public, and it deters others from similar conduct. So I understand what you're saying, and appropriate relief is broad, and that's right. That could be a lot of different things. But I think it has to be somewhat narrowly prescribed by the context being an individual employee bringing a claim for discrimination.
Okay. I'm enlightened. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Is Your Honor's line of questioning just evidence, in my view, the appellee's position, if adopted by this court, would essentially be to reconstruct the statute from appropriate relief to any relief at all. And that's essentially what they're asking the court to do, which I would suggest is not morally right. In fact, if you go back to the question that counsel asked you to consider about what's morally right is that a company knows in advance that its conduct is subjected to punitive damages. In this case, my client could not have known that. It's morally right for, if you're going to make a common law claim, for you to plead it in your pleadings and give notice to both sides that you're making that claim. That didn't happen in this case.
Run that by me again.
Excuse me?
Run that by me again. What did you just say?
Whether you are making a common law claim and a statutory claim simultaneously. To the issue of whether it's wise, of course it's not wise to allow both claims at the same time. This court, of course, has already decided that question in its decision in Dossie-Jamko. But even ignoring that precedent, it's not wise because imagine if you could bring a common law cause of action and or a statutory cause of action, then you could completely circumvent the administrative review process that's set forth in the statute to allow the Department of Labor to look at this claim first to determine if it has any merit before the employee proceeds with the claim.
Maybe the point is that it's wise for the judiciary to allow the democratic institutions of government, the legislature, to determine what's morally right or wrong.
I agree, as opposed to a jury representing a very small segment of society, as opposed to the General Assembly representing all of us here in Virginia.
As opposed to the judiciary enhancing a remedy that's not otherwise apparent in a statute.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And in any event, in this case, because of the interpretation that's been adopted by OSHA, which doesn't permit a private cause of action, but the Secretary of the Department of Labor on the federal level can bring these claims if you pursue it and file a claim. In this case, that wasn't done. And so even under OSHA's own interpretation and the federal court's interpretation of the federal statute, there potentially could have been punitive damages imposed in this case, not necessarily for the benefit of the employee, but punitive damages imposed. The employee just didn't seek it. So they're suggesting that somehow that the Commonwealth would be less safe to the extent that the court doesn't adopt their interpretation of the statute. That's just simply not true. In fact, by allowing the Secretary at the federal level to address that thing, what you actually have is more fairness because you can have equal application across the board by having a single body determining whether in a particular case punitives might be available or not under federal law. But it's clearly under the Virginia statute they're not. Wilson v. Whitaker makes that clear. If what's fair and just can't justify punitive damages and derogation of the common law, certainly appropriate relief can, especially when accompanied by all this compensatory language. At the end of the day, these type of cases are best addressed through the administrative process. First and foremost, and to allow these co-claims for statutory and common law just wouldn't be practical and wouldn't be fair, and in any event, in this case, those claims weren't made. So for purposes of this case, it doesn't matter. And to the notion that the cause of action already existed in this case prior to the 1979 enactment of the statute at issue, that's simply not true. This cause of action and the right of action both rose and fall with the enactment of the 1979 statute. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Call the next case.